You don't build a business based on competitive nature or mm-hmm. control. Mm-hmm. You build it based on what the consumer wants.
When Sam Newell started his career, making his first six figures seemed like an impossible mountain to climb. Now, he's a seasoned real estate pro with over $350 million in real estate transactions so far. Sam's opening up his playbook and sharing the mic with his inner circle of experts, partners, and investors. Together, they'll dive deep into the biggest wins, losses, traumas, betrayals, and more that have made up the path to unparalleled success. It's time to get leveraged with Sam Newell.
Ed, thank you for joining me.
Glad to be here. Thanks for coming by the office.
This is a beautiful office. I'm excited. This is the second time we get to do a podcast together.
Yeah.
And for those of you that don't know Ed Kaminsky, I want to introduce him really quick. Ed, I've told you this before, but you've been inspiration in my life for a lot of years before you even knew me. And I'm going to just introduce our listeners to you. So guys, Ed Kaminsky has been doing real estate for over 35 years. We're here in the LA area. Specifically, what areas do you cover, Ed?
I've covered a lot of areas in my career, but we're mainly located in what's called the beach area, the South Bay, which is Manhattan Beach, Hermosa Beach, Redondo Beach, and the Palos Verdes Peninsula.
Awesome. Yeah. Very cool. Well, you have an impressive list of achievements, and I want to give our listeners a little bit of an idea of what you've done in your career, and then we're going to talk about how you did it and where you started, because I think a lot of people see how successful you are, and they want to know, you know, how you got there. So, guys, Ed has been a high-producing real estate agent for a long time. When I started in real estate, I looked up to Ed, and so you've got over $2 billion lifetime sales volume, and yep. that's a huge number. You've been a top 10 producing residential real estate team in the country. Also, you and your team were the top producing mid-sized team in EXP, which is the largest real estate company in the world.
Yeah,
that's huge. That's awesome. And then last year, you did $292 million in sales volume. You're the founder of Sportstar Relocation. You're the lead counsel at EXP Luxury Global. You've been featured in Wall Street Journal for being a top 100 real estate agent. You were awarded the best marketing campaign, and that's something to say to your sellers, which is huge. Real estate's all about marketing for the leaders in luxury. Then you've been featured on ESPN, Fox, NBC, ABC, HGTV, Bravo, Fine Living. You have your own rap video, which I was able to see, which is awesome. Won't forget that one. And you're also an investor with Multifamily Investment Club, which I really appreciate. And it's been fun doing deals with you in Cleveland and other locations. But Ed, take us back to Cleveland before you were doing real estate. And just tell us about young Ed and what motivated you to move out to California. And just tell us how you started.
Wow. if I go back to young Ed, everyone has their humble beginning story, right? Mine wasn't horrible, but we definitely came from nothing, right? My family didn't have much. So I always looked up to my friends that lived in nicer houses, drove nicer cars or that sort of thing. And it was just a driving factor for me at a very young age. Okay. And so I remember getting my first, called my first business at 7 years old.
Okay. Nice.
And I was driving around with my bicycle and ended up behind some sticker factory. And they threw out a bunch of stickers and they said KIB. And below it said cash is best. Obviously, they must have misspelled it or something. I don't know.
Somebody got fired.
But I started selling stickers and I learned about a lot of things at that young age. A couple quick lessons. We'll keep it quick.
Sure.
Number one, I started selling one sticker at a time. And that was a slow process. At about a nickel a piece, it was taking a long time to get to a dollar.
Yeah.
And I wanted a dollar. So then I said, why don't I just go to school where there's a bigger audience? And I took them to school. And I sold it to every student in that class that morning. Nice. And right at the end of the class, the teacher said, Ed, I want you to return all that money to all the students and they get to keep the sticker. Apparently, wow. I didn't have a license to sell stickers in school.
So in kindergarten or first grade, yeah.
So apparently, Jeez. You have to have a license.
Okay.
So then I went into mass leverage, and I said, I'm going to distribute 100 stickers in a bag at a time. So they would distribute them. And lo and behold, a few months later, I started seeing these stickers on cars everywhere, and I knew I made it. So that That's was awesome. My first business, and I made all of about $2.33.
Nice. That's awesome.
So, no, I had a figure it out yourself mindset at a young age. And so that extended, and skipping all the stories in between, there was a lot of them, really up till I was about 18 years old. And my parents couldn't afford to send me to college, and I wasn't going to figure out how to pay for it myself. So I said, I'd just skip it. It just seemed like the right thing to do and go in the jewelry business. Mm-hmm. And I heard there was a school in California. It was a 6-month course. Go there, the Gemological Institute of America, the GIA for those that buy diamonds. And I went there. And the main reason I chose that industry at the time was because my father was sort of in that industry when I was 18, and I seemed to want to follow him with whatever he was doing. The problem was he changed his job about every year. So that was the year.
Got it.
So once I got my degree, I flew back to actually Houston, Texas. So I had a little stint in Houston, Texas where he was. Mm-hmm. But by the time I got there, he already changed careers. I thought I was going to work for him, and I didn't. So... got a job in the jewelry business, and they made me a manager when I was 19 years old.
Wow.
And so I started managing this store, and my wife hated Texas. I married her when I was 19. I had a baby at 21, so I started young.
Yeah.
And we said, let's go to California.
Okay.
Came to California, got back in the jewelry business, and then I started discovering late night TV. I don't know if you remember Tom Vu.
Mm-mm.
So some of you remember Tom Vu. But Tom Vu was this Vietnamese guy who made it in real estate, and he drove boats with a bunch of women on it, and he was very successful. And I thought, maybe there's something in real estate. So yeah. I got my real estate license, and that's how I got my start. I got the license and started receiving job offers in the mail.
Okay.
And I thought that was the craziest thing, because to get the job in jewelry, I must have sent out 300 resumes.
Right.
I got maybe, three or four offers to come in to talk to somebody and a job offer. But in real estate, they just offer you the job.
Right.
But then as I started interviewing with these companies, they said that I could work there as long as I write them a check.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I learned you're not really getting paid to get in the real estate business. You're getting an opportunity to build a business.
Right.
And so I quickly learned that. And my first 6 months, I sold a house. The day I got that check, I quit the jewelry business and went full time.
Awesome. How much was that house?
That house was $200,000. It was $200,000, $600,000. You can buy a house for $600,000
yeah.
back then.
Yeah.
It was $200,000. 3% was $6,000. I got half of that, which was $3,000. That's what it was. I got a check for $3,000.
$3,000. What year was this?
1987.
Okay.
So I knew with $3,000 plus the $3,000 in commission I made in the jewelry store that month, it was December, I had $6,000. My expenses were $2,000 a month.
Okay.
So I knew I could live for 3 months.
Nice.
And if I just work really hard, I'll get it done. So I put myself on a 3-month limit and I went to work. And I sold 17 homes my first year.
Wow.
And that was substantial enough to double or triple my jewelry income and really get going. But hard lessons in the beginning.
Yeah.
Hard lessons.
The story you just described is so relatable for so many real estate agents and just straight commission people who get in, and whether it's car sales, real estate, jewelry sales, a lot of them have maybe a month or two or three, or they'll make a commission which keeps them afloat for the next 2-3 months, And it can be a tough business.
It can be tough. And I knew the responsibility was on my shoulders to support my family. And I had two kids at that point.
Okay.
I was all at 20X years old. I don't know, 25. I don't know what it was. But
yeah.
I had a lot of responsibility. And so I just knew I had to go and do it. And, you know, those that try to break into the real estate business, and I look at them and I say, you have to go do it. And they still don't do it. You know, it's a very perplexing way the mind works. But I knew how to do it and I was going to figure it out. I was determined.
Ed, you said a few things there that I want to hash or rehash. Number one is you're not satisfied until your clients are happy. You're always thinking about how can I take care of these clients. That's something I've had to learn to do in my business. What did was not natural for me. One thing that was natural for me is I'm just going to outwork everyone else. Not naturally good. And if Kobe Bryant hadn't had the work ethic he had, he would have been a really good basketball player. He would have not been one of the top 2-3 players ever.
Yeah, a thirst for education, knowledge, to find ways to improve myself was a constant. It was early in my career, it was in the middle of my career, and it's still. I keep discovering ways to go find more people that are sharing and collaborating, mm-hmm. great ways of growing the business. And yeah, I'm looking to satisfy my clients, but I'm honestly looking to satisfy myself, right? I want to look at myself in the mirror, whether it's looking at my books or my book of business, and say, yeah, I'm doing it. I'm doing things that are hard to even believe in my own mind that I did that. And when I can look at my business at that level, that to me is fun. And I'm not there yet. It's like, I feel like I barely hit the tip of the iceberg when it comes to doing what I'm potentially capable of doing. And I'll give an example. Yes, I've hit around $300 million a couple years in a row, but I am absolutely confident that I can hit $1 billion. And if I can hit $1 billion, I can hit $2 billion in a year. Really believe that is possible. If the systems are right, I train my team right, I coach them, we provide great customer service, we create raving fans in the business and do great things for our customers and elevate everything we do every single day, I think that's incredibly powerful. And there's something written on the board and you can't see it. At least you can't see it. It says CBE. I learned something about that. And I think it's something I've naturally adopted without knowing it. But this was about, speaking Lakers, right? In, I think it was 1986, the Lakers lost the Western Conference Finals.
Mm-hmm.
And Pat Riley, the coach at the time, walked off the court. And he said, we have the best basketball team in the NBA. Even though he lost, he believed he had it. But something didn't work for them to win the championship. So what did he figure out in the summer? He went back and looked at every statistic that there was that a player could have. Mm-hmm. And he walked in and wrote on the board, CBE. It stood for career best ever. Meaning every single player had to look at each and every one of their stats and improve it by 1%. If they could improve their stats by 1%, they could potentially win the championship.
Wow.
What'd they do? They won a championship in 1987, and they went back and won it again the year after. It was the first time an NBA team won back-to-back championships in 20 years.
Wow.
All for focusing on that 1%. Just read it with James Clear in Atomic Habits. Teaches the same thing. So just improve a little bit each and every day or each and every year, and that will... in real estate, it's compound interest, right?
Mm-hmm. It's the compound effect.
The compound effect.
Yeah.
So that can work in business. Work on every little thing that you can work on, improve it by just a tiny bit, and big things will happen.
I like that. And, the compound effect has massive, massive implications in your business. I believe you can hit $1 billion for sure. There are real estate deals that I never thought I'd be a part of right now. We took down almost a $70 million property last year that I could have never dreamed to take down a property that big.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, you've been a big part of that as well. So right now, what are a couple of the little things, the little one percenters that you're doing? What's an example? Let's say, you know, you've got one of the most successful teams in the country. I think our listeners want to know, what are you telling your team, maybe a new agent or people on your team, to improve on? Or what are your goals right now?
Well, they have to improve on improving.
Yeah.
They have to improve on improving, right? So identify the weaknesses in your game, in your business, in your career, and work on it. I think that so many people want to take a shortcut. They want to get their real estate license and then they want to be a billionaire or a millionaire or whatever it is, right?
One thing that when I saw you on stage at Mike Ferry and when I saw Hal Swayze's and these other fantastic realtors, Neil Weichel and Michael Young, different agents who have been achieving for a very long time, I learned about mindset and improving your mindset. And today it was interesting. I was at lunch with a gentleman who has taken multiple companies to 7- and 8-figure exits and 1- to 9-figure exit, barely older than me. And I was like, damn, like that's impressive. And he's just really good at putting together the systems and the operations and finding good talent. And I just thought to myself, like, what's stopping me from putting together the right team? And really just came down to mindset. And what's stopping Ed Kaminsky from hitting $1 billion in sales? There might be a couple mindset tweaks or something that...
I heard it this week. So I was at an event, you know, out learning again. And I didn't believe this word existed in my life, but then I thought differently, right? Because I believe all of us can be way ahead of where we are right now. Mm-hmm. You could be way ahead of where you are right now had you made different decisions 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I could be way ahead where I am right now if I made different decisions a year or 10 ago. And there's one word that it all kind of wreaks havoc in our brain. It's called fear. There's a lot of different fears I think that can pop up that we're not maybe admitting to. Fear that we're going to make the wrong decision, that this could go wrong this way, or I shouldn't hire this person, or I shouldn't fire this person. Little bits of fear of making the wrong decision pop up for me, for all of us. And I think that does stand in our way. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how do you break through that fear? How do you power through and just be bold enough? Yeah. And just say, hey, I don't care. I don't care what anybody thinks. I'm just going to do what's going to move forward my vision in a certain way. And I think that's a mindset that I personally have to work on a little bit from time to time. And how do I do it? I'll tell you, because I know you're going to ask. Mm-hmm. I do have to work on it. I mean, yes, I'm born with this hunger and this competitive fire, and I can't turn it off. I really can't. But I do think I do allow bits of fear to pop in. So I work on my mindset through reading really great books. Mm-hmm. I only read, honestly, educational things. And I use Audible now, mostly. Yes. I mean, I may pop on YouTube and watch some stuff if I'm on the treadmill or something. And so I just continually fill my mind with that. Or if I'm feeling a little funky, I was in the gym yesterday and I didn't put YouTube on in a while, and I just put in motivational whatever podcast, and it was just going through all these really great clips and sounds and words, and you know what? It just fired me up that morning, and just it gives you a little fuel to power through the day.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the big differences I've noticed between top producers. You and I have the opportunity a couple times a year to go hang out with top producers in Vegas or wherever these conventions are in San Diego. And when you talk to them, when you sit down with them, they say the same thing that you've said, is I consciously work on improving my mindset.
Yeah.
You were feeling a little bit down, feeling a little funky at the gym, maybe didn't have enough energy. You watch something that energizes you. Or you watch something that motivates you. And, you know, when you talk to these other top producers, they're not always super motivated all the time. There's no lack of fear there. They have fear. And a good example in my company was fear of payroll. We just hired 6 people in the last year. And we weren't quite sure if we could handle the new payroll. And now we're hiring another 3 immediately in the next couple of months because it worked so well for us.
Yeah.
And it was fear that held us back for about a year of not hiring the right personnel.
Well, I think business growth in general can be a challenge, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going through those growing pains right now. I've always grown just on this nice, steady rise through most of my career. The beginning, I skipped it, but the first couple of years of my career, I got a little aggressive in real estate purchasing and had to go bankrupt. That feeling of bankruptcy and never, ever wanting to be there again was also part of my drive through a big part of my career.
Wow.
But past that moment, it's been this nice, steady rise until the pandemic hit and I made a decision. I want to do something even bigger. Wow. Everyone was pulling back and I said, nope. As a matter of fact, I did something my staff did not like, but the day the pandemic hit, I called them all. I said, I'm cutting all your salaries by 25%.
Wow.
And that was on Friday. And by Monday,
we were in Park City together. Was it while you were in Park City?
When I got back from Park City, yes.
Yeah.
So I got back from Park City and I said, that's it. All your salaries are cut. And it did not go over very well. Yeah. And I started thinking all weekend long, I think I'm doing the wrong thing. I'm thinking wrong.
Yeah.
I'm thinking wrong. And on Monday I said, it's all back. We're back.
Interesting.
You got a raise. So, and I said, you know what? I'm doing the opposite. I don't care what everybody else is doing. It's pedal to the metal. We're going to push. We're going to push. We're going to work harder. We're going to call all of our clients. We're going to be there for them. We're going to kind of console them through this crazy time and figure out how to push. And then I said, over the next few years, I want to expand my team.
Yeah.
I went from a few staff member and a few agents. Last year, we hired 25 agents. I think we're at 24 by the end of the year.
Wow.
Which is really big growth. We doubled our staff. The payroll is off the charts. And I think for the first time, we're experiencing expenses that aren't as high as income. And it's an interesting experience to go through.
Yeah.
So then you look at ROI and different things you do and how great are your people doing and where do you grow income and how do you get those lines reversed again? So, I'm throwing business challenges at myself and just powering through.
Well, that's what made you make the decision to change back from cutting payroll by 25% to saying, nope, I made a mistake. Let's ramp up.
I called all those so-called top producers, honestly. I said, what are you doing? What are you doing? And I don't know. It was just one phone call with one person that sparked a thought in my head. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to let the world control where I'm going. I'm going to take control and we're going to find a way to help our customers and continue to grow our business regardless of what's going on in the world.
And how did it go in 2020?
2020 was a record year. I mean, we all know that April of that year was horrible.
Yeah.
But May kicked in and the real estate market was great. And we really got a big market share and we had our best year ever. And 21 was the same, right? 22 was a little bit different, honestly. We saw a market shift and that's when I decided to grow. And as I was growing as a team, growing my staff, growing our agent staff, we just increased expenses, decreased income. So it was not the year ideally wanted, but I do know and I do have the vision and I do have the belief and I do have the faith of what I've put out there, what's capable, whether it's a billion or 2 billion or a half a billion, whatever it is, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm not going to not let it happen. And I'm not 100% sure how it all will happen or what day it will happen. It's going to happen.
That's awesome. I love hearing that. And you know what's interesting is I started my first podcast in March of 2020. It was called Recession Proof Real Estate Investing. I thought, oh, wow, perfect timing.
Yeah.
And I interviewed people like you and Mike Darda. Mike Darda grew his market share in Florida by a huge percentage because he kept working.
Yeah.
But the overall message when I talked to Brian Burnett, when I talked to you, Neil, Hal, Michael, many other Capri, many other Valerie top producers, they were actually putting in more effort when everyone else was saying, holy cow, the world's ending. COVID is taking over. There's a shutdown. They said, okay, I still have this goal. I've got to get to this goal. What am I going to do? I can't cut efforts. I've got to double my efforts.
Well, that's happening right now.
It's happening again.
Happening right now. We had determined in last week, and this was through studying some analytics with, what was it, Habib. Have you ever seen this guy, Barry? He's really smart.
Mm-hmm.
In order to do the same amount of business, we'll put it this way. If you do exactly what you did last year, you'll do 50% as much business this year.
Yep. Yep. So
something's got to change.
On that note, there are REITs and massive companies that are real estate purchasing companies. They hold real estate. They're estimating a decrease in acquisitions of 95%.
Wow.
Because they don't think the deals are going to be out there. They think the brokers are going to stop working. Sellers are going to stop selling. And so in order to still make money, I've told my acquisition teams, we have to look at, instead of 100 deals to buy one, we're probably going to have to look at 400 or 500 every quarter to buy one.
Yeah.
And so we're 5 and in some cases 10xing our efforts.
Yeah.
Because we still have to do at least 50 to 100 million this year
right.
to pay the bills, to keep growing as a company. And my goal is to get to $1 billion in holdings by 2029. We're right around 200 million. We've got a long ways to go.
Yeah.
And we can't let a market shift, and you can't let a market shift affect your profitability. And that's what a truly mature business owner does, is they say, okay, here's what the market's doing. Here's what I'm going to do to keep producing. So what else are you guys doing to keep that up?
So you have to really dive into what's working as far as profitability, right? So I think, you know, I shared these numbers with another group today. If you want to look at your numbers closely, you have to look at your numbers closely, right?
Mm-hmm.
Most good businesses are operating at a 20% return. Restaurants, even the real estate business. You know, a lot of people think, oh, you make 100%. You make 100%. You make 20% after everything.
Yeah.
So if you're doing something to generate revenue, you have to 5X your return on investment, right?
Mm-hmm.
For it to make sense. If you're not getting a 5x ROI on something you're doing, then you might as well just get rid of it.
Yeah.
Right. So looking at every single thing you do and how it's growing, and then go back to the 1%, you know, concept, that what are we doing that's working? How do we improve that? Whether it's 1%, 10%, 50%, whatever those percentages are, you have to continue to find ways to improve what you're doing. Whether it's your funnels you're building to create lead generation, to what you're communicating to the clients.
Mm-hmm.
I discovered just this week that I've been counting on others to, hey, just write some stuff, get it out there, get it posted, right? You know, send some emails. And you know what? I should do it. Get my voice out there.
Yeah.
Take some time and put that out there. Where that fits on my plate of time, it's not a lot of room left. But you know what? There's different things you have to think differently to improve. And that's looking within yourself as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, on that note, guesting on podcasts could be really huge for you. You know, you've been on my podcast a few times. You've done live videos with me. We've done dinners together. What we are recording now is going to get chopped up, and that's free content to you.
Yeah.
So yeah, thinking outside the box of maybe I just need to jump on a bunch of other people's podcasts. Maybe you don't start your own. You don't have time for that. But I think always improving is really important. And part of that for me has been having a coach. You know, Kobe Bryant, at all times, had 2 or 3 coaches helping him improve. Because after he'd won 2 rings, he wanted to win another. And he won multiple rings after that. And he probably would not have had he said, I'm good, made a lot of money, won a couple rings. So tell me about how coaching has affected what you do and how you keep improving and hitting those goals.
Well, I think coaching is a big part of what I seek out to look for the truth in what I need to do. So I've had a business coach as long as I could remember, and more than one, and many times. I've had a health coach I've had a workout coach. So I look for people that will tell me the truth, hold me accountable, and push me a little bit harder than I might push myself.
Yeah, I mean, coaches are going to see things that naturally you're a little bit blinded to. You know, they're going to point out things, different things. But one part of the show I always like to bring up is, what is the story of a maybe a situation or a client, funny, sad, whatever, that really affected you? I've got a few in my real estate career. But can you think of a client or a situation that really helped you become the Ed Kaminsky, the top producing agent that you are today?
I have to pause for a second because I'm trying to think of stories that really helped me. You know, I think when I think about what clients have helped me, it's always been, and there's a several that have come through my life who were absolute, we'll call them detail oriented, high demand people. And there's a few clients, I won't name names since this is broadcast nationally, wherever it goes, that they really hold your feet to the fire. They're expecting a phone call from my staff, from myself, within 38 seconds. And they expect paperwork to be correct. And they'll find one I not dotted, one T not crossed. And they will tell you. And they make it sound like that's a really big problem. And so I welcome those clients. I know my it drives my staff crazy. I said, listen, you need to appreciate these clients because they make you better. So when you deal with a normal client who's not so demanding, it's a little bit of a breeze, right?
Yeah.
But I've had a few of those clients that have been tough as hell and just made us all better. And then I'm just have to teach my staff to embrace it and be okay with it.
I love that. Have you ever had a staff member say, or a team member say, I don't really want to do that. I don't want to rise to the occasion? Or how have you dealt with people on your team that way?
You know, I think what we do deal with naturally are people that are disrespectful, rude, mean, right? And so I'm there to back up my staff if those situations happen, let them know it's not them. It's not the staff. It's the client. And maybe they just had a bad day.
Yeah.
Right? And don't take it personally. Just do what you know is the best and right thing to do. And listen, you know, we work hard to work with clients that like us and respect us. If we have to fire a client, we have to fire a client. It can happen.
Yeah.
So I'm not afraid to do that. If it's really harmful to our culture, the staff, the team, the company, and if the client's not happy with us, they're probably happy to be rid of us anyway. So. Yeah. It doesn't happen a lot, but that is the action we'll take if we have to.
Right. Well, and Mike Ferry, one of my favorite things I learned from Mike is if you produce, you don't have to put up with clients that you don't necessarily want to work with.
No, it's 100% true, right? So you see agents that are struggling with their business, dealing with buyers that never make a decision because they don't have the motivation. They probably don't need to buy a house, but they'll just put up with it.
Yeah.
So if you have, if you do a good job in building your pipeline and your client base, then you have the luxury of working with people that are going to actually like you and respect you.
Yeah. And let's go back to, because I think this is really, really important what you just said. You've had clients that have held your feet to the fire and they've been very detail oriented, as have I. And one thing that we just did is we got all our K-1s done by the first end of the first week in March. We've never done that before. And a lot of real estate investment firms don't get them done until second quarter. We wanted to stop using that excuse. And I said, you know what? We're just going to do it. We are going to do it this year. Now, there's two investments that we're minority partners in that we can't control the K-1s. Those obviously aren't done.
They won't I know be done. My accountant appreciates it because he's hammering me every week. Why do you have all these LLCs?
Yeah.
You
know? We've got, I mean, yeah, we've got 29 LLCs right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, 12 different properties. And yeah. Lyndon and my team and my bookkeepers, I made their life hell for really since December.
Yeah.
Like, hey guys, K-1s. We finally got our numbers back mid to the end of January. And that's when we could actually check the numbers and then turn them over to the accountants. Then we made our accountants' life's hell. We actually had to fire an accountant, hire a new one because they weren't going to give them going to get them done in time. But that motivation to get it done and be unlike the rest of these real estate investment firms, I could easily say, you know what? Blackstone doesn't give K-1s until June. This company, that company.
They don't want to hear it.
Nobody wants to hear it.
No.
And I've had a few clients, they're friend of yours and mine. I won't name names either. But two that I can think of, he and she have been really the squeaky wheel that I could have responded and said, holy cow, like these guys just shut up. Just like stop complaining about K-1s. Everyone else, you know, does it by June. And instead, and I think that's why this caught my attention, is I had the approach like you had, is, well, no, like these guys are definitely some a little bit tougher to deal with. They're in my ear, you know, every week. When are we getting our K-1s? When are we getting our K-1s? And as a company, we chose to rise to the occasion and outperform our competitors and do a better job. And we chose to take it as a learning opportunity. And we're trying really hard across the board to do that. So I think you bringing up difficult clients in the real estate business, you can have completely unreasonable client expectations, and it happens a lot.
It does.
It's one reason I hated showing homes. The buyer that just never buys, that has the wine taste and the beer budget. You know, it's the old joke. But I think that's really important. Would you say, other than that, what is something that has really contributed to growing? I mean, you guys grew by a huge amount. You went up to almost $300 million a number of times, right?
Mm-hmm.
What else as a team, because there's a lot of people trying to grow teams right now, helped you really grow and get to the next level, whether it's client happiness, marketing?
You know, I took the business one time and broke it into 10 categories. And I said, what if I increase by 10%? I go back to my numbers. If you take 10 categories of your business and break it down and increase each one of those by 10%, it doesn't look that hard to achieve, okay? If I did 100 deals, I need to do 110. If I'm closing 80% of my appointments, I just got to go to 88%, right? If I sell 40 buyers a home, I go to 44, whatever that is. And I broke it down into 10 categories. If you hit 10% on all those in 1 year, you double your business. Double your business. So a lot of times we're focused on one category. Oh, I got to get up from 100 deals to 150 deals. That's a 50% increase. That's tough.
Yeah.
That's really tough. But what if you increased your sales goal by 10% and increased your average price by 10%?
Mm-hmm.
Now it's you're getting closer to what you want to achieve. So looking at the business in increments as opposed to just numbers, one number, not just the commissions, not just the number of transactions. So taking all those and increasing by 10%.
Got it. I like that. So you can grow and improve in multiple facets of your business by 10% or whatever that number is, 1%, whatever that is.
You're increasing lead generation, output of phone calls, all those different things that you're producing.
No, I really like that. And that's one thing I focused as I've coached my team. You know, I've had real estate teams for the last few years as well. What is measurable and what can you improve every day? What can you control? Yeah. You really can't control a house selling. You can't control what it sells for, but you can control how many appointments you set by getting on the phones. You can control the price points you focus on. Just like you said, you can control how many of your past clients you reach out to. And what are, I don't know, a few things. We're getting towards the end of our time, but the market's really tough right now. Interest rates, unprecedented interest rate hikes last year. You mentioned it caused some struggles for your team on how to grow and keep growing.
Mm-hmm.
What are you guys doing right now? What are a couple of those 10% items that you're trying to improve on and adjust to this crazy market?
I'll tell you the biggest one. Called stopwatch time. Okay, stopwatch time is if you're going to challenge yourself to make sure you're doing the right thing, what is stopwatch time? Stopwatch time is specific business generating activities that's actually driving revenue to you. So in the real estate business, you can take any business, but in the real estate business, it's writing contracts, it's showing property, it's talking to clients, it's calling new clients you don't know, prospecting. Right? So anything that's specific client interaction, what's not, getting on the MLS and looking around, doing a property analysis over here, dealing with an escrow, not stopwatch time. So challenge yourself. How much stopwatch time do you actually have in a day?
I love that.
You'll be shocked how little stopwatch time most real estate people have. And if you want to really grow your business, look at what you're doing that's producing income. And are you really working? You hear people say, I work hard. I work so hard. Oh my God, I worked all day.
Yeah.
What'd you do? Oh man, I was working on this file and I had to deal with this refrigerator and
social media posts.
Yeah. It's just absolutely nothing that's actually driving the business. Yeah. And then they wonder why they're not hitting their goals or not making the income they want to do. They're not getting their family to the vacations they want to go to.
Right.
They're not hitting their stopwatch time.
Yeah. And that's huge. With my teams, I always call it, what are your money-making activities? What are the three things? You got to talk to clients and set appointments. You got to go on appointments. You got to negotiate contracts. And most real estate agents spend very little time actually talking to clients, going on appointments, and negotiating contracts.
Yeah.
They're busy work.
100%.
But if you don't do the busy work, you got to go do the hard work, which is contacting new clients. And that is tough.
If we're going to stick to our industry, it's lead follow-up. And we built this city. Why am I thinking of that song? We built this business on talking to people. But the one thing we've learned is the lead flow that comes into the companies now, our real estate companies, they're not the same type of lead that maybe we had in the past. And they need more contact. They need more nurturing and they need more attempts. So we discovered that we started last year saying we have to try and attempt to contact them a minimum of 12 times by phone, text, and email, those three ways, or video text. I started yesterday, 30. 30 is the new minimum for my team.
Really?
30 attempts. People that don't want to talk to you will hang with, they'll tell you. They'll let you know.
Yeah.
If they might want to talk to you, they don't tell you, which means they're giving you permission to continue to contact them.
Yeah.
So for those of you that are getting contacted by salespeople and you don't want to call them, they're going to call you back, right? A good one will until you say no or yes, right? It's reality.
Yeah.
I get called by people all the time and I don't call them back, but I actually hope they call me back when I need them.
Yeah.
I don't need them now. So I don't say, you know, whatever, you know, don't contact me anymore. I just like ignore it.
How many deals have you lost from following up too much? Probably not a lot.
I can't think there are any. No.
But how many deals would you say you and your team could lose by not following up?
Oh, at least $1 million a year in business.
Minimum.
Income. At least $1 million in income per year for not following up. I can count it. Every year.
Yeah. I always had a rule. When a lead comes in, you got to call them within 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Twice a day, every day for the next 5 days, morning and evening.
Three times a day for 10 days.
Okay.
Phone, text, email, and mix in some video text with that. And you will watch your numbers improve.
That's huge.
Yeah.
That's huge. That's awesome. We're getting really close to the end, but I know one thing a lot of people are really interested in, Ed, is sports star relocation.
Okay.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
So we've got a Cleveland Browns helmet here.
Go Browns.
Go Browns.
The least winningest team in the NFL.
That's okay. They're still fun to watch.
They are.
A lot better the last couple of years.
Oh, they're much better.
A lot more fun to watch.
Yeah.
But tell us about how you kind of built that, or what's your goal now? Because you've worked with a lot of stars. To me, that sounds like a lot of fun.
It's a tough business, right? But, you know, people want to know how did it get started. I helped a player couple decades ago. I don't know how many it was. And I thought, well, that was cool. I'd like to do that again. But I kind of stayed in touch with that player, got to know his wife, and then went to events. I went to charity events, and they would introduce me to somebody else, and the wife would introduce me to a wife or the player to a player. And so I just kept getting introductions and then helping them and helping the next one. And my competitive nature said, I want them all. I want every LA athlete there is. So I should just get them all.
Yeah.
And I made that determination. And the next week, players came to LA. And guess what? They didn't call me. I'm like, what the hell? Mm-hmm. Why not? I already said I work with all athletes.
Yeah.
But it was just in my head. So I said, well, that doesn't work. So I said, why don't I get to know every real estate agent around the country that works with athletes and create a network? And that way, if someone's coming from Dallas, I call my Dallas connection, refer me in, and then I'll make sure I get it. So that was that competitive nature, and I was going to control the market. And then I realized from being in business long enough, you don't build a business based on competitive nature or mm-hmm. control. Mm-hmm. You build it based on what the consumer wants.
Okay.
So what did they need that we could provide? What if we build a concierge level of service around that relocation and help them get their car there, their household goods moved, help them get the utilities on and utilities off, and you know, deal with the frantic spouses that just got ripped out and they lost their hairdresser, a nail person, and everything else they're dealing with, and really just be there for them for all of these different things. So that's where the relocation concept came about, and really just increasing the services that we provide to these players and their wives and the families. I mean, kids getting ripped out of schools, yeah. right? They're all a little frustrated. You think they're excited to get a new team, but the reality is, It's not fun for them.
It's still work for a lot of them.
Yeah. It's not fun. So we're just there for them. And that's how we built that business. And we've been all over the country helping these guys.
That's really cool. So you yeah. built, in short, the Nordstrom experience for relocating athletes and really covering all their bases, no pun intended. But, you know, these athletes that are moving, you know, they get transferred to a different baseball team. You've got everything covered from hairdressers to packing their stuff, moving their stuff. The new agent in the city they go to is probably pretty low on the list. You're taking care of their actual lives, which is important to them. And that was what I just heard, is you focused on what they wanted, not what you wanted to do. Not you wanted to dominate the
it
market.
Sparked,
you wanted to
compete. It sparked within me what I wanted, but I had to quickly turn that off and move it to them.
That's right? Cool.
That's what we've learned in business.
When you've got the auction company as well, right? You just did a huge, huge deal in, I don't know if that was on the auction or not, that Northern
no,
Idaho
No, that
deal.
Was Idaho. I sold a $30 million home up there. And it wasn't through the auction process. I've actually sold that company. But
okay. The
Idaho deal was that seller said, my buyer's coming from California, told some realtor. That realtor said, there's only one guy in California that can pull that off. That's Ed. You should talk to him.
Nice.
And so I flew up to Idaho, saw the property, partnered with an agent up there, and we got that on the market, sold and closed in 119 days.
Wow.
And I pulled my buyer from California.
Wow. Yeah. That, I mean, that had a helipad, didn't have its own landing strip.
It had two airplane hangars, had a helipad on the property, airplane hangars at the airport. It had the largest boathouse I've ever seen, 2,500 square feet. I mean, not Jeez. Massive, but bigger than an average house.
Yeah.
The house was huge and beautiful. That was right on the lake. It was
in Lewiston?
Coeur d'Alene.
Coeur d'Alene.
Yeah.
In Coeur d'Alene. Wow.
Yeah.
So $30 million. Is that your what's your biggest transaction ever?
That's effectively my biggest transaction as a single sale. Although I double popped a little house on the beach for $17
million. Nice.
So that was $34 million if you count both sides.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So, you know, one thing as an agent myself, I think I don't want to end with this. The mindset of working luxury, sports stars, luxury. I don't know anybody better than you or has a better track record than you or has built a more successful business focusing on luxury, sports stars, celebrities. When I got in the business, my broker actually told me, I don't like working with people over 300,000 because rich people are greedy and hard to work with. And in 2018, that was my last full-time year in real estate. I made $1.2 million, which for me was an insane amount of money. But I started focusing on the people that were making 7, 8, 9 figures in Utah because I figured out very quickly those people are actually better to work with. And it was a complete and total mind shift change and shift of who I wanted to work with, who I wanted to spend time with, and the level of service and the type of service. So talk to me a little bit about how different it is, or maybe it's just normal for you, but working with the higher end clients, the luxury clients, you're on the board at EXP, on the luxury board. What are just a couple of tips for people like me who maybe started a little bit intimidated by that luxury client base? And what are a few steps to get into that? Because you said a while ago, improve something. One thing everyone can control is their price point. I can focus on million-dollar homes in Utah all day long. There's plenty of transactions going on.
When you're dealing with the high end, you are dealing with a clientele that real estate is not a place to live, but it's a part of their wealth creation. It's an asset class. They look at it differently than the average Joe. And they also like to talk about it with their friends and their wealth manager or business managers, and you know what's what, right? So you have to talk about real estate differently than, let's say, you're dealing with a $600,000 home in a general neighborhood, right?
Right,
it's a place to live, it's where they want to put their family, very important, but it's not their, it's not, it's different. It's so you have to connect with them on that level. They also want to know who you know, right? Mm-hmm. So if you worked with the Joneses and the Smiths and doctor this and tech owner this guy, and they know that's important. In that business, they want to know that you've achieved in the past. So yeah, breaking in, it's tough, right? So you just have to get, you got to start with one and work another and work another and start moving up the ladder.
Yeah.
You have to know how to communicate with them in a different manner. They expect a much higher volume of communication. They expect the conversations you have with them are, you know, informational, educational, about negotiations and everything going on, what you're going to do to get that job done. So it's different. You know, probably interesting, you know, conversation I had with somebody, which was they were shopping for a $3 million home, mm-hmm. pretty high end for most markets. And they hated what they got in our market for that. So we kind of went up to five.
Yeah.
And at five, they didn't hate it. They didn't love it. They said, well, maybe we should go to seven. Or maybe we should go to nine. And like, yeah, you're getting close, Ed. But we just, for that much money, I don't love it.
Yeah.
And then I listed something for 17. I thought, oh my God, this is perfect for them.
Yeah.
But they had a you know, a perceived limit of where they're gonna go. And I was like, you know what? This isn't about spending money. That's a wrong conversation to have with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote them a letter. And I said, I sent it to one of them, of the two, the spouse. Because she wouldn't come look at it. She knew it was over their intended budget.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent a letter. And she says, oh, my God, send it to my husband. And the letter basically said, listen, this is not about spending money. This is just about a decision of where you want your asset allocation. And they're smart people. They have smart advisors. They know what works. So I can't tell them what's right or wrong, but just point them to look in the right way, in the right direction, and said, you could have beachfront real estate as an asset allocation, which has probably been one of the highest appreciation assets in the world, or you could have it wherever your financial advisor is saying it should be. You don't just spend a nickel.
Right.
You're just moving it from one of your pockets to a different pocket. And if it's in this pocket, you get to hang out there. If it's in that pocket, you just get a bank statement or a stock statement,
right?
Or a business owner statement, whatever it is. So you decide what makes sense. You talk to your advisors. And he said, Ed, we'll buy the house.
That's awesome.
So we went from $3 million to $17 million, and they couldn't have been happier.
Interesting. That's a really cool story.
Yeah.
So you helped them really do a mindset shift of, here's what we think we want, because you're very good at what you do. Guys, you need to allocate more funds because it fits what your lifestyle is looking for.
Yeah, and I think they were just looking at it as taking their savings account and spending it, right? Yeah. Which it kind of feels like it, but it really wasn't.
It was an investment in their lifestyle and an investment in their goals and what they wanted for themselves.
And that asset has increased in value very, very well since they bought it. So
that's awesome.
They've done great.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Well, time to be done with the podcast, Ed. It's been awesome. So we talked about some things that I think our listeners are really going to appreciate. A couple of things that I appreciated hearing about was your commitment to taking care of your clients and how you're so damn competitive. That's really what I think sets a lot of the you top producers apart, whether it's real estate or whatever you're in. It's been really fun watching your business. But lastly, I want to talk about investing really quick.
Yeah.
And just a 30-second spiel. Why are you investing in real estate? I know you have lots of other investments, but specifically real estate, what gets you going? And why do you invest in, let's say, real estate versus anything else that you invest in?
So first of all, there's two parts to that briefly. One, if I'm producing income anywhere, I've learned from reading Warren Buffett or whomever, right, that if I can produce income, can I take that produced income and have that produce income? And so the only thing I know that does really well for me is here's what I love about real estate investments. It produces four pieces of income. Everything else is one, maybe two.
Mm-hmm.
Stocks can go up in value and spit out a dividend.
Right.
Cash just spits out interest, right? Treasuries spit out interest, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those are single or double producing assets. And real estate for me produces four ways. I have the cash flow that's coming in. So that's number one. Number two, we have appreciation. It's been proven that real estate appreciates at 4.5% a year nationally over time.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, we have depreciation, or the bigger word for that these days, you know, is cost segregation, right?
Yeah, tax savings.
Tax savings. And then the fourth is
your principal pay down.
Principal pay down. So the tenants paying your your mortgage down, so your principal is reducing. So you got four ways of making money when you do real estate investments. That catches my attention. I understand it. And every investment I made that failed was not real estate.
Interesting.
I bought crypto last year.
Oh, man.
And it happened to be in a company that went bankrupt. So it's in this app, and I can't get the money out of the stupid app or crypto, whatever it is. So that failed. I invested in some Bernie Madoff investment type of thing. Got my butt kicked there. Invested in a family member's really ingenious tech company. Lost 100%. All these outside investments, I've lost 100% of my investment.
Holy cow.
100%.
You and everyone else.
Each time I put it in there. Yeah. So I quit. I quit. I'm just sticking with what I know. I give my wealth manager some assets because my accountant says diversify. So yes, some goes into the market, into equities. I don't look at it. I don't make decisions. They do that. The rest goes in real estate.
I love that. Well, and you're one of our top investors, and you have been for a few years now. And we actually put on a little dinner, which you were at. And there's a couple deals where we're not making the cash flow that we want. Definitely, we wish we were better. But so far, we haven't lost a dime.
Yeah.
And with banks failing, with crypto companies failing, and with different challenges that are in the market, we feel very, very fortunate that we're as conservative as we are. And so I appreciate you saying that. I mean, I'm not happy you lost money, Ed, but I'm really happy for all the money you did throw into real estate, because you've put a lot of your earned income into real estate, which is now producing passive income. And some of the deals that you're in have already gone up by 50% value.
I'm going to close with this statistic. I think it's important to understand. If anybody's thinking of investing in real estate, the question is, what is its long-term health? And a statistic I saw from a gentleman this weekend blew my mind. But we are heading this year in 2023, the largest buying population of real estate for a home, not necessarily investment property, mm-hmm. but for a home, is age 33. Hmm. We have the largest group of 33-year-olds hitting the market in 2023.
Really?
So you have the biggest supply of home buyers. Housing starts are massively down. Mm-hmm. Inventory is massively down. To give you an example where inventory is, in 2007, we had 4 million homes for sale in the U.S. Right now, there's 978,000 homes for sale.
Holy cow.
Of the 978,000 homes for sale, 400,000 are already under contract.
Wow.
Less than 500,000 homes available for 313 million people in the United States of America right now.
Sheesh.
There's a supply and demand issue going on that is going to keep real estate a very safe long-term investment over time.
Absolutely. Everyone needs a place to live. That never goes away.
Watch the news, talk about housing bust and balloons or whatever they call, what do they call the damn things?
The housing bubble.
Housing bubble, thank you very much. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It's not there because of supply and demand. Mark my words, tape to me, mark these words right now and look at this 3 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. You'll see what's going to happen.
Yeah. And the last thing I would end on is that's absolutely right. What will keep you safer when you invest in real estate is getting long-term debt. So if you're worried about a housing bubble, let's just say there is going to be a housing bubble. It doesn't matter if you don't need to sell.
That's true.
You put a 30-year mortgage on a house here in Manhattan Beach with Ed Kaminsky, you have no risk.
The average equity in a home right now compared to the market crash of 2008 was less than 20% equity in a home then. There's almost 60% equity in the average home right now.
Wow. And people are just sitting on those.
And they're not forced to sell.
Yeah.
They're not forced to sell because they have a strong equity position.
Yeah. Why would you? You got 3 to 6%
mortgage. And you're forced to sell. You let it foreclose. The bank dumps it and crushes values. It's not going to happen right now.
Yeah. It's not.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Ed. This has been really,
you're
really
welcome.
Fun. You're a top producing, nationally ranked real estate agent. And I hope our listeners, I know I learned a ton today. I think I benefited the most. But I'm excited to see what your team does over the next year. It's a really challenging year. I know you guys are going to be at top again. And hopefully we'll talk to you again and see how you're doing. But thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Sam. I appreciate you coming in. It's always a pleasure to sit with you and learn from you. I think you think really, really big. And for those that are listening to you for the first time, I think there's a lot of big things coming your way. And I'm looking forward to watching you succeed.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
You got it.
Thank you for listening to the Get Leveraged podcast with Sam Newell. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and share this episode with the person who needs to hear it most. Tune in next week for another incredible conversation. We'll see you there.